Accession number 13107, row 2.
Mr. Miles, row 2. I was asking you if the sailors took Chinese girlfriends in Hong Kong.
Yes, it did happen, but not very often. Yes, it did. And their share of living ashore, but very, very few.
Was it frowned on by the Navy?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, but nothing they could do about it. You were free as the air when you went ashore. But all my time was spent in, and which most of us did. There were three lovely cinemas in Hong Kong and another three, I think, over in Kowloon. And that's where we spent our time. We would go to the cinema, probably go, if there was anything good on, we'd cross the street and go to the next one. And then we'd go down and have a meal, stay ashore overnight, you know, bed for a shilling, and then come back at 7 o'clock the next morning. Lovely. That was while we were in Hong Kong. But of course, in the summer, we used to go up to a place in North China called Wei Wei. And there we did a lot of exercising with the fleet and so on up there. And it was a lovely place, really. All sports grounds. We played a lot of football and stuff up there. Fleet competitions. And the regatta was held up there. And so on.
Whilst you were in the Far East in 33-36, did you run into the Japanese forces?
No, we only ran into the Japanese once. I went to Japan. We went to Japan a show the flag thing, you know. I think it was 35. And it's a thing that sticks in your memory because we went to Kobe in the Inland Sea. And the day before we got into Kobe, they devalued the yen. So that, and they devalued it by 50%. So you know what that means. You go ashore you change your money and you get double the amount of yen that you got the previous day. But the goods ashore were the same price. So we were, I bought a tea set, which my daughter now has, a 48-piece tea set, which I sent home. They packed it and sent it home on one of the Japanese Maru boats. And the whole thing, the set, plus the travelling home, cost me 7 and 6 months. 48-piece tea set. I've got one or two things here around now that I bought at that particular time. So when we went to Japan, we had a wonderful time because things were so cheap. We were well received by the ladies, but couldn't get on with the men.
In what way?
The ladies would be very polite. You would go into a bar or something, you didn't do anything. I mean, you couldn't take a cigarette out of the packet, they'd come and do that for you. They were so used to doing that for the men. Well, when we used to sit away and do it yourself, they thought this was wonderful, you know, that you did these things yourself. But the men, of course, hated it. Pretty obvious. But that was a wonderful period. I went to three places in Japan, a place called, opposite Hiroshima, a place called Miyajima. It was a wonderful place. And we went up to Kobe, and we went to Kyoto and one or two other places. Absolutely marvellous trip.
Was there any sense in those days that Japan was a threat?
No. There's one thing I'll say about Japan. It's the only country in the whole world that I've ever been to, and I've been to most, that lived up to its storybook telling at school. Everything else, you just said to yourself, thank goodness I was born an Englishman. And that still applied even to Japan. But it lived up to what you read about Japan. You went into a bar and they had a cherry tree in bloom there, that sort of stuff. It was absolutely fantastic. But in those days, of course, they wore Japanese dress as well. Now, of course, it's all westernised, isn't it?
Yes.
Completely different. But then it was a wonderful place to go to. Absolutely. Absolutely.
What happened when you'd finished with the Parthian?
Then I came home. I was promoted to petty officer. I came home and I was made then promoted to what was called second coxswain. And I went to somewhere called the Otway, where I expected to do 2.5 years as second coxswain before possibly being promoted to coxswain. However, I only did 6 months and I was sent to a course over Vernon again, you see, the electrical side, the torpedo side, and I qualified for torpedo coxswain and left the boat, and I then went to H31. There it is up there. H31, and that was my first boat as a coxswain, and that was in 1937, and that was the loveliest little boat I was ever on.
Why?
Oh, that boat was built in 1918, and it was well ahead of its time. There was no steering wheels or hydroplanes, you know, as such. A press button, electric buttons. Modern times. And the officers were wonderful, and they gave me some wonderful recommends, you know, while I was there, what a good job I'd done and all the rest of it. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. There was only 23 in the crew, and because as coxswain, you're chief of the boat. You see, they're not known as coxswains today. They're called chief of the boat. You were responsible for the whole crew under the captain and the first lieutenant, you see. But that was a great little boat. So then I was on her for about 7 or 8 months, I suppose. And then I was redrafted to China as a coxswain, see? One coxswain to each submarine. But there were 6 of us drafted to China. And 5 of them went out by liner, second class, you know, a really good passage out. But one had to take a tug to China, the St. Just. It's in there, is it?
Yes.
I think so. So I was sent to the St. Just, a little tiny tug in Sheerness, which I had to take out to China, together with submariners, because the reason for that, I take it, was because we were small ship sailors and weren't likely to get seasick. So I took the St. Just out to Singapore with the boys, with the crew, and then went up to Hong Kong from Singapore on a Blue Funnel ship, which was a nice change because the tug was coal. And of course, when I got to China, to Hong Kong, the other 5 had all gone to submarines, but I was what was called spare crew in case somebody went sick or whatever. So I was then 6 months spare crew before I myself went to a boat, which was the Regent. But herein lies the funny story. The thing was, I was the only one of those 6 coxswains to come home. Now, I had the opportunity of not taking the St. Just. I was suggested to me that I didn't have to take the St. Just to China. So I said to the drafting coxswain at that time, why not? He said, well, it's up to you. If you don't want to take it, I'll find somebody else. So I said, oh, no, that's all right. I'll take St. Just to China, which I did, because I could see myself. I could see that it could be good, you know. I could learn a lot. I had to know navigation and all the rest. I had to do officer watch and so on. Little did I think that had I changed and let somebody else go, that I would have gone down and this other fellow would have come home. That's how it happened. I was the only one out of the 6 to come home.
So it's just a question of luck.
Luck and, I suppose, integrity. It was an awful job to take us and just to China. Nobody wanted it. There was a certain amount of integrity. I feel like I did well out of that. So when I got out there, I was spare crew and went to the Regent. And that was it.
What kind of a submarine was the Regent?
Oh, she was... I think what you have to remember there, there were 17 submarines in the China flotilla. And that's where we were when the war started. But when the Italians came in, we all moved into the Mediterranean. Now, I was still left in Hong Kong. We were docking, the two of us, Regent and Regulus, we were docking. The other 15 submarines went into the Mediterranean with the Medway parent ship. And we followed on about a month later. I think only one of those 17 submarines survived, and that was the Rorqual. All the remainder were lost.
But when you first joined the Regent, what kind of duties was she doing then? Just exactly the same thing that you'd had...
It was peacetime when I joined.
In the Parthian?
Yes, that's right. Only I was coxswain, chief of the boat. My responsibility was the whole crew, of course. But, yes, we were doing the same kind of thing. Aztec running with destroyers and that sort of thing. Showing the flag around the South Pacific there and down to Java and Borneo and everywhere. Philippines, we went.
How did you like the job of bosun at first?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, it was great. Great.
Why was that?
I don't know. I, as I said, when I joined the submarine service on the 5th of May in 1932, I knew I was home, and I never ever looked back from there.
How did you react when you got the news about the outbreak of war?
Well, we sailed from Singapore about 5 days before war broke out, 3rd of September, wasn't it?
Yes.
And we were allotted a billet in a place called the Sunda Strait, that is between Sumatra and Java. There were two of us and the rover. The rover was at one end of the Sunda Strait, and we were at the lower end. And we were there before war was declared, and then on the 3rd of September, war was declared, and I always remember the signal. The signal came through and the signal read, total Germany. We were at war.
How did you feel about it?
A bit dicey. We didn't feel too bad because we were out of the actual start of the war. It was the submarines at home going over across to Germany and Heligoland and so on that were going to suffer. And of course they did. But what we did, of course, there were lots of German ships out there, merchant ships, plus the Graf Spee and von Scheer and three or four armed merchant cruisers. But what we had to do as far as possible was to keep those German ships in ports so they didn't come home, which is what we did. I don't even know of one German ship that left to come home. We kept them all in harbour, Batavia and Japan, and a place called Sabang in the north of Sumatra, and so on. And so we were patrolling and poking our nose into the harbour to let them know that we were around and stop them coming out. And of course, eventually, they were nearly all sold to the local people because they couldn't get any wages and stuff like that. They sold their cargoes and all that sort of thing. And they just stayed there till the war ended. We had one bad period down there. We went down the coast of Sumatra. We were looking for the von Scheer, which was supposed to be in that area. And there was a little island off of Sumatra called something like Simula or Similae or some such name as that. And they had a very deep, hidden harbour inside. And we tried to go in there on this occasion, and there was a heck of a rip-roaring tide, and it swept us up on the shore. And we were high and dry. And when I went up onto the conning tower, I could have walked ashore without getting my feet wet. Right high and dry. So we had to... We pumped out all our fresh water, emptied all our salt water tanks, of course, and we had a, used to have a section of the keel which was known as the drop keel, weighed 20 ton, which would give you additional buoyancy in an emergency. We let that go, and we managed to get off, but we were in a bit of a mess. And we got out of harbour and out to sea, and the skipper said, I'm going to try and dive, Cox. And I said, well, don't think we're going to have much luck here, sir. So he said, well, we can only try. So we were 20 ton light with this drop keel having gone and all the fresh water gone. So we dived, but we couldn't control the boat. Had to come to the surface and come back to harbour. And then from then on, that's, we continued to do that. But when the Russian Stalin-Hitler pact came about, you see, that was in early 1940, I think.
It was August 1939.
This was, yeah. Was it 39?
August 39, just before the war was declared.
Just before the war. Well, we had to do patrols off of Vladivostok. I didn't do one up there, luckily, because it was terrible in the winter, ice and snow and everything. But they could see all the Russian ships going into Vladivostok, loaded with stores for Germany. Couldn't do anything about it, of course. They were flying a Russian flag and they were neutral.
How was it that you missed them?
Hmm?
How was it that you missed those patrols?
Well, I don't know. We seemed to do ours down the south. I did three patrols down at Java and Sumatra and one round to as far as Ceylon. And so I missed that. But you imagine, there's two boats there, one going from Vladivostok on one patrol in all the ice and snow and then down to the south of the Pacific in the heat of Sunda Strait and Java. No air conditioning or anything, you know. It was terrible. We had people sent home with prickly heat, just an absolute rash. And as the coxswain, I was the doctor as well, you see. That was one of my responsibilities, the medicine cabinet. And
did you know anything about it?
Not a thing. Not a thing, only what we could read up in the books. We never had any instruction on it.
What type of things did you have to deal with?
Well, I had a chap chopped off all his fingers, whether intentionally or not, is debatable.
Of his right hand?
Yeah, his right hand. Mm-hmm. I had another one who blew a main fuse in the motor room and burnt every hair off his body. All at the same time, these were. And then I had two with venereal disease. They were very, very lucky people. We bumped into one of our own cruisers, the Birmingham, and managed to transfer them. Otherwise, I don't know what would have happened. I could only have treated them. That was it.
Were you able to do much for these four cases?
Oh, the one who chopped his fingers off. Oh, another one who slashed his artery in his wrist. The one who chopped his fingers off, I think I had him 2 weeks before we got back to harbour. And this was in Alexandria. And I'd left the boat, was coming home, which is a story on its own. And I'd been round and I'd had a couple of tots of rum with some friends in the Medway. And suddenly the tannoy went. The chief put off some miles was required down the boat. I'd left the boat there and I'd been relieved by another coxswain who was made up. So I was half drunk. I thought, crikey, wonder what was going on. So I went along and went down to the boat. Well, when I got along to the foredeck of the Medway, the parent ship, and looked over the side where our boat was laying alongside, there were four officers on the casing of the submarine. And this was in 1940. One was an American commander. Another one was an American four-ring officer. The third one was my own captain. It was also half drunk, as luck would have it. And another officer, which I can't remember, I think it was a paymaster. Now, even at that time, it's in 40 before the Americans came in the war, they were learning how we coped. So I went down to the boat, and that's what they wanted to know. How had I treated this chap so that his fingers were fine? So I just said, well, I used to soak them, and not some stuff called aquafavine. Have you ever heard of it?
Yes.
And I used to soak them in that.
It's for burns.
Yes. And is it?
Well, I think so.
No. No. Aquafavine was a not so strong as iodine. The same type of stuff, but not so strong. Lighter in colour than iodine. Aquafavine. No, you're thinking of...
Never mind, anyway.
It's in tea. You get it in tea leaves for burns.
Tannin.
Yeah, something like that. I'll think of it. However, when we got back to harbour with this chap, I saw the surgeon command and he gave us congratulations on what we'd done. So I said, well, what do you do now? He said, well, would you like the sea? So I said, yes, I would. So I went to sick bay with him and while they doctored these, and one never realises until you actually see it done, they cut all four fingers down there, both sides, like that, and peeled the flesh back, got a pair of nippers and nipped off the top of the bone, and then put the flesh back. So they had cushion, made new fingertips, you know. Really interesting to watch this sort of stuff. But we never had any training in that. You had to use your own judgment.
Had the chap cut his wrist?
Oh, yes.
To get out of the war?
No, I think he was just drunk, and he put his fist through a window. And it slashed him across there. This was in a place called Amoy. And I had to take him ashore to an American hospital and they stitched it up, but no problem there.
Now, you said you moved and you told me about the duties that the boat had in the Mediterranean. What was it expected to do?
Oh, well, the main thing, of course, I always say the main thing was not so much sinking ships, it was to prevent them coming to sea. In other words, in our case, to prevent them getting across to North Africa and reinforcing the troops in North Africa. Excuse me. I'm not in very good voice today, unfortunately. But of course, any ship that we saw, we would have to go at, which we certainly did. But, you see, those 17 submarines from China. They'd been in China since 1930. They'd never been home. They were refitted with Chinese labour, which, although satisfactory, was hardly really successful, so that the boats were noisy. And the Italians were particularly good at picking up sound. They never had ASDIC as such, but they pick up sound quite easily. So the boats were too old, too big, and too noisy. They were all we had, so we just had to go. You see, in the Mediterranean, you could see a submarine from a plane 100 feet down. And this was where a lot of them were picked up, I think.
Can you tell me about the highlights of your patrols? In the Mediterranean,
well, that story you've just read is a part of it. I did three patrols in the Mediterranean. The first one we didn't see much. When I say much, we saw there was a big... Do you remember the big air raid on Taranto Harbour? Well, we were there when that happened. And we were actually sent there, of course, waiting for the ships to vacate Taranto Harbour and find new homes, and which, of course, they did. And we saw them come out. We could only see the mastheads. We couldn't do anything because they were inside the minefields, see? Well, on occasion, you could go through a minefield. But we'd already lost four submarines, or five, in that area. So they're very sticky about allowing us in there. So we never went in, and they got around. But other than that, that first patrol was a sort of a shakedown patrol, and we never saw much, never... Never had any problems at all. The second patrol was absolutely incredible. I mean, what happened there is nobody's business.
Can you take me through your memories of that second patrol?
Yeah, I'm getting a bit dry. Yes, I think it was about the 29th of September we sailed from Alex to go on our second patrol. And, because, we only do have to dive all day and surface at night. So when you're dived, you can only do a very slow speed, otherwise you're burning out the battery. So you only do 40 or 50 miles during the course of the day, 15 or 16 hours. And when you service at night, you have to use one engine for charging the battery to bring it right up to the top again, and the other one for proceeding to your area. So in the course of a 24-hour run, you probably didn't do much more than 150 mile or 200 mile. So from Alexandria to the south of Italy, it was probably about 900 mile. So it took about 5 days, you see, to get to your area. And we sailed, I think it was on about the 29th of September. No, just before that, I think. Because it was on the 30th of September when we were still proceeding to our patrol area, which was south of Taranto. And I happened to be on watch in the control room at the time, and the officer of the watch suddenly called out, get the captain masts in sight. All right, so we knew we were in for something. And it turned out it was two battleships and I think two cruisers and eight destroyers, I think it was. And we were in a very fortunate position. We were right ahead of them. So it meant that if we stayed where we were and they did an order course, we were going to finish up in the middle of them, which was fine. And they were around about 1,000 yards apart between the three rows. You see, the battleships in the middle and cruisers in the middle, and two rows of destroyers on either side. So we had to get inside the destroyers in order to fire torpedoes at the battleship. And we were in the ideal situation, providing that they didn't alter course. Because unfortunately they did alter course. They used to do a zigzag course at that particular time. And they altered course away from us. That meant that we were then outside the destroyer screen. So that also meant that we had to dive under the destroyers in order to get at the battleships. Well, it's a very, very hairy procedure. You've got to go down to at least 60 feet in order to get underneath the destroyers. Then you've got to keep the periscope watch, in case of alterations, of course, and to keep your bearing and so on and know what bearing to fire on. Well, the captain decided to fire a salvo of torpedoes at the leading battleship, which was the Littorio Veneto, a brand new Italian battleship. And he was going to fire on a 90-degree angle, which is like that. That's us, and that was there. So you lead them, of course. But in the course of getting under the destroyers and being blind, when we got up inside the screen, he'd missed the 90-degree angle. So he had to fire on a 145, which he did. We fired a salvo of torpedoes. Only five went, one stayed in the tube. And at a 145 degree, that's lovely, had they gone. Now, from then on, we don't know. We don't know what happened. Either they saw our periscope taking the final sight, or they zigged again on a new course, and the fish went up on either side. Now, Gus Britton, down at Gosport, is trying to get the Italian version of that. Might be a thing that perhaps you could do yourself.